There is a lot of drawing to be done that I would not have time to do. Of course, if you try to follow this lecture, you would spend all the time drawing. So what we've done is we've put these slides in the webpage, website of the school, where you get all the problems.
Yes, the ones are already out there. Both yesterday and today, slides.
Okay. So today, actually, they were placed yesterday, but there is an updated version now. So I'm going to follow this updated version. Very good. So second lecture on tensor networks. I wanted to start with a brief summary of what we saw yesterday concerning matrix product states. And remember that what we're trying to do here is we're trying to efficiently represent wave functions of n spins. And we had this diagrammatical notation where we said this 2 to the n coefficients can be understood as a tensor with n legs. And so we are going to draw this as some circle, or in this case, a rectangle with n legs, n indices n legs. And what a matrix product state was a decomposition, or a particular way of writing, assuming some structure in this tensor such that we could write it as a tensor network of this form, as a product of small tensors. And what was the point of doing that? Well, if we look at each tensor has three indices, one that I call I, that runs over the possible states of a spin, spin up or spin down. And then these bone indices alpha and beta that connect this tensor with neighboring tensors. And the idea was that if the size of these bone indices is fixed, is independent of the system size, independent of the number of spins, so if we fix the size of alpha and beta to take chi values, say 20, and then, of course, this bone index, the physical index has the dimension of the local Hilbert space, say in a spin 1/2 system, it will be 2, then what we have is that the total number of parameters that we have to specify a single tensor is chi squared times d. And we have n of those in a wave function for n spins. So the total number of parameters that we're going to be using to specify the full wave function is order n times d times chi squared. Very good. So remember, this was answering the question, do we have an efficient way of representing wave functions through this tensor network? And the answer is yes. We have an efficient way of representing the wave function. It takes order n coefficients. But another question that we had to ask in order to decide whether this tensor network was useful is whether we can efficiently compute with it. And the first example of computation would be just let's compute the norm of this state represented by a matrix product state. And we discussed yesterday that you could accomplish that efficiently by regarding this as a sequence of multiplications where you start, say, from the left and consider two tensors at a time, multiply two tensors at a time, and you do that, and after two steps you see that you are back to a certain situation, except that you've moved by one side to the right. So what you realize is that you can multiply all these tensors together in order n steps. It takes order n steps. And at each step, you only need to multiply two tensors at a time. And the resulting tensor is also a small tensor. So you never produce a big tensor in the process. Okay, so this means that the cost is proportional just to the system size. And we were very happy about that, because it meant that we could compute the norm, but also, similarly, we could compute the expectation value of local observables, say sigma z on site 1, 2, 3, 8 or so, and so on. Very good. So that meant we have a tool to play with. We have this efficient representation of certain class of wave functions. And then the second type of questions that we had to answer was, well, is that particular variational ansatz, many-body ansatz, is it useful for anything in terms of does it describe states that we might be interested in? And to answer this question, or to get some intuition about what the answer might be, we looked at two properties that follow just from the way we've connected the tensors together into a tensor network. Okay, so there was no variational optimization of parameters, nothing. We just look at this tensor network and we ask properties
structural properties that follow just from the way we have built the network. And in particular, we can look at entanglement entropy and correlations. And I did not have time to explain this yesterday, so this is new material. Oh, by the way, I'll be using slides, but one thing that I think went quite well yesterday was all this interaction we had, so please feel free again to ask as many questions as you have. Very good. So the first, then, I want to argue that the entanglement entropy in the matrix product state is upper bounded in a very simple way. So what we want to do, remember, is we have a projector, or we want to build the reduced density matrix for certain region A, which will happen to be the central, these 10 sides in the middle. So what we're going to do is we're going to trace out the spins corresponding to par B, to the complementary of par A. And that is the tensor network representation of this tracing out. Okay. So what we've built here is the reduced density matrix for part A. We assume that the whole system, A and B, are in a pure state that we represent with a matrix product state. And now what we're doing is we're building the reduced density matrix. And the question we want to answer is how much this entropy is, the entropy of the reduced density matrix. And the answer will depend on the variational parameters. So we cannot answer the exact value of the entropy, but we can give an upper bound to it. Right, so it is connected. It's just the same. So what you see here is the brand, the cat, right? If you want to compute the reduced density matrix, you take your state, outer product brand cat, right? You build a projector. You have to build a projector, and that's what is represented here. That's right. Okay. So maybe I misunderstood your question. So A is connected. Very good. So this is nothing but the tensor network representation of this reduced density matrix. I hope this is clear. And then the observation is that we can split the indices corresponding to the cat from the indices corresponding to the cat to the bra by cutting only two indices. I'm going to just regroup these tensors to make this more clear. What I'm saying is that this reduced density matrix can be expressed as a simple tensor network made of two tensors. So the first tensor up here could be a collection of all the tensors on the top and the ones, these three and these three down here. And the lower tensor could be, is the product of all these tensors with open indices. And remember, this is the bra, this is the cat. So what we have is a density matrix that can be expressed in terms of connecting bras and cats by through an index that now takes values alpha and beta. It's a composite index representing both this index here and this index there. And so what that means is that we have a representation of the density matrix as a sum of chi-square terms connecting bra and cat. Okay? So what you want to realize quickly here is that that implies that this density matrix can have at most chi-square non-zero eigenvalues, okay? Because you're connecting the brand, the cat, through chi-square terms, that sets an upper bound to the rank of this density matrix, to how many non-zero eigenvalues you can have. So what we see is that the connectivity in the tensor network, after taking this partial trace, gives us an upper bound on the rank of the reduced density matrix. So then we can estimate or upper bound the entropy. We say the entropy of this density matrix is the entropy of its eigenvalues, but it has at most chi-square non-zero eigenvalues. Okay? And now we just need to use the well-known fact that if you have a probability distribution with chi-square values, this entropy is going to be at most the entropy of having all these eigenvalues to be the same, right? So what we get is that the flat distribution will give you more an upper bound on the entropy. Flat distribution of chi-square possibilities gives you an upper bound on the entropy of the reduced density matrix. Okay? And so from there we get this entropy is at most then log chi-square, the number of possibilities, which is this 2 log chi. So from here what you have to read is that we had to connect two cat, two indices to split the bra from the cat, two indices, and then what we get is that the entropy in this case is at most 2 one per index, log chi. Okay? If we had to cut 20 indices, then we would have a 20 here instead. So what we get is a general result that the in a tensor network, if you want to split one region from the rest, you can look at how many indices, the smallest number of indices you have to cut to separate that region from the rest of the wave function. And that number of indices gives you already an upper bound to the entropy of that region. Is that clear? That's a yes, right? Oh, very good. So what we've seen then is that just because of the structure of the tensor network, the way we connect the tensors, we get that the entropy of a region, connected region, will be at most 2 log chi. And notice that we didn't use the fact that, I mean, if we had chosen a smaller region, say we also trace out this guy, right, then we would have that this line would be twisted here, and we still would cut 2 lines. Okay, so the number of lines we have to cut in order to split region A from the rest is independent of the size of region A. And so what the conclusion then is that the entropy as a function of L may grow, but it's upper bounded by a constant. Okay? So conclusion is that the matrix product state, the scaling of the entropy in the matrix product state is upper bounded by a constant, regardless of the size of the region you are looking at. And that should remind you of what happened. This is an example of this area law in one dimension, where it says that the entropy goes as L to, entropy in one dimension goes as L to the 1 minus 1, so 0 dimension. Okay, it's a constant. Very good. And then, so this is as far as entanglement entropy is concerned. And then there is this other question of how correlations decay. And that's something we saw yesterday. So let me quickly review it. What we said is a two-point correlator evaluated on a matrix product state, assuming that all these tensors are the same, say, in a translation invariant state. What we see is that this expectation value, this tensor network for the expectation value, is of the form, or is of this form, which amounts to saying we have a vector here, some transfer matrix to the L minus 1 power times a vector. And so this transfer matrix will have some largest eigenvalue that is picked in this calculation to the L power, or L minus 1, which which is equal to L if we put the minus 1 in the constant. And so that automatically means that we have exponential decaying correlations, that the correlations in the matrix product state at long distances are going to be of exponential type. Good, so we can put these two things together. And we've seen that just from the way we connected the tensors into a tensor network, correlations are going to be at long distances of exponential type, and entanglement at long distances or cannot grow. It saturates at most to a constant. And then what we have to do is to remember that these are properties exactly of ground states of one-dimensional systems for gap Hamiltonians. Yes? All I'm saying is, if it's true that you manage to represent the exact wave function, maybe approximately, but if it's true that you get a good approximation to this ground state through a matrix product state, this approximation will have this saturation of entropy. It could, in principle. I'm not going into these details because we have not discussed optimization of the tensor network. I wanted to have a discussion at a higher level prior to any type of optimization. So what this tells you is, don't use a matrix product state to represent, say, a wave function that has power law decay of correlations, because it's not going to work. At least at long distances, it's not going to work. How can you make, sorry? You could, you cannot do that. For any finite bond dimension, it's going to be finite correlation length. Do you think you can, I mean, the conclusion is that you cannot. You can get good approximations to it, okay? But what we are saying here is that you won't get the long distance behavior correctly. This wave function will not reproduce the long distance behavior correctly. OK, very good. So this was. So since you have a finite correlation length, if you had the ring, provided that it's sufficiently large, whatever is happening at the bound, when you close the ring, it's too far away from the places where you want to analyze the two-point correlator. So this finite correlation length will mean that you don't see beyond, much beyond that correlation length. So whether the system at infinite is periodic boundary conditions or open boundary condition, whether you connect the tensor network at infinite or not, it won't make a difference. When I say at infinite, I mean even for sufficiently large finite sizes. You could have first order phase transition. But this is not a system. This is an ansatz for a wave function. You conclude that if you manage to the conclusion is that you should not be using these ansatz to approximate the ground state at the quantum critical point. That's the conclusion. Okay, perfect. So what I want to do today is to talk about another tensor network, which will be more appropriate or naturally equipped to represent precisely quantum critical systems. So remember, we have this wave function, and we've been discussing that in some cases. We've been discussing an ansatz for one-dimensional systems. And now I want to discuss another ansatz for one-dimensional systems. So this is, again, an ansatz for ground states in one dimension. And what you can see is that in the matrix product state, the geometry of the tensor network, in some sense, was following the geometry of the system. It was a one-dimensional system, so I'm going to use a one-dimensional array of tensors. Whereas in this case, what we're going to do is we're going to use an extra dimension. We are trying to represent the wave function of a one-dimensional system, but instead of connecting the tensors just in one dimension, we'll explore, we'll consider connecting them also in a second direction. Okay? So again, we're still targeting ground states in one dimension, but we're going to exploit an extra dimension in the tensor network representation. And when I say that this is a mirror multiscale entanglement renormalization ansatz, there are many variations of it, and actually today I'll be switching from one to the other if I find it convenient. What's important here is that we have tensors organized in rows. There is a direction which we'll see corresponds to scale, and then we'll have two types of tensors, ones that go from 2x to 2x. We also have this tensor that goes from 2x to 2x, and then tensors will go from 2x or to 1x in the upper case, or here from 3x to 1x. You know, these are small variations. These all these variations belong to the same type of variational ansatz. Very good. So remember what we have to ask from a tensor network in order to determine whether it's interesting to use it. First, computational questions, then physics. So let's start with the computational questions. Efficiency. We want to see that we want to argue that we can efficiently describe wave functions with these ansatz. Remember, in the case of a matrix product state, if we had n spins, we would use n tensors. So order n parameters were enough in order to specify the wave function. And the question is now, what are we going to do here? How many parameters do we need? And that's a question for you. So what I can see here is that we have n spins again. And we grow in this extra dimension, which has length logarithmic in the number of spins. So you may wonder if you need n log n tensors. And maybe a question to you is, how many tensors am I going to be using here? Sorry? It is order n. Yes. So indeed, what you realize is that you have log n rows, but each row contains half. So in the first row, you have n tensors. In the second row, you have n over 2 tensors, n over 4, and so on. So this is n times this number, which is smaller than 2, so order n tensors. Okay, so we're using an extra dimension without increasing the leading order in the number of variational parameters. Okay, So the answer is yes, we have an efficient description, and it's order n. But of course, we want to also analyze how expensive it is to make calculations, computations with these ansatz. And so the first question we asked for the IMPS was how much is the norm? And we got this simple answer that we just go from left to right and multiply all these things in order n, cost order n. And the same for, we just saw this, the same for expectation value of a local observable. So I want to ask the same questions for the mirror now. Okay, just to convince you that it is possible to efficiently evaluate or extract information from these ansatz. And so this is the wave function. This is the scalar product. And you should already be, you know, feeling uncomfortable if you remember what I told you yesterday. If you try to coarse grain a two-dimensional tensor network, you run into trouble. The cost is exponential in the linear size. So in the smallest linear size here would be only logarithmic. So maybe you would be fine. But it turns out that I didn't tell you the whole story. These tensors in the mirror are not just arbitrary. They are full of variational parameters, but these tensors are constrained. So part of the answer is that this is a unitary transformation. So these tensors here with 2 to 2x, which I'll be referring to as disentanglers later on, they are unitary transformations, and the 3 to 1x are isometric in the sense that when you take it, when you multiply it with its adjoint conjugate, then you get identity. Same thing here. And the top tensor is normalized. And so what this means is with these constraints, which are part of our definition of the variational ansatz, it turns out that it doesn't cost us anything to compute the norm. Why? Well, because if this is the norm that we want to compute, if we can use the rule, say, let's use this rule first. This is U and this is U dagger. And so everywhere here, pairwise, all these four-leg tensors will disappear. And after that, we're left with this, say, W and W dagger, but we look at our table and we say, okay, that's constrained to be the identity, so this also disappears. And you can see how there is a cascading here of annihilations, pairwise, of tensors from the ket and the bra. And so you keep going, and you realize that this tensor network, the tensors were constrained in such a way that globally the tensor network was already normalized to 1. Okay? The wave function is already automatically normalized. So we can efficiently, well, we don't need to compute the norm in the first place. Very good. But and you saw the same when we dealt yesterday with a very simple quantum circuit. The norm, we didn't need to compute it. So actually, the mirror we'll see later, it's actually also a quantum circuit made of unitary gates, or it can be interpreted in this way. But for the time being, let's focus on the harder calculation, which is the expectation value of a local observable. And then what I'm going to do in this case, I want to justify that again, we can efficiently compute this. But if we look again at the tensor network, it looks like it's two-dimensional. Now we will use the same types of cancellations to realize that here I can again, U and U dagger can cancel also here and in many places, and then automatically this W will cancel with this W dagger. And what we get is that this tensor network is simplified to this one. Now I've not been able to say simplify this U with this U dagger because there is an abstraction to it. Okay? So the presence of the operator that I want to analyze is an abstraction to having certain cancellations. And so I'm left with this tensor network. But this tensor network, luckily, is one-dimensional now, in the sense that there is a direction, which is a scale, but there is nothing else. I'll justify this in a second. So what we want to do is we want to be able to analyze this tensor network. And what we can do in order to do that is to identify that this is a sequence of a small transformations, a small manipulation. So what I've done here is I've taken this tensor network, which is the expectation value that we want to evaluate, and I've marked a box in red and in green. And here what I do is I take this box and I say, okay, there are a few tensors inside. There will be some cost attached to making this calculation. So I can multiply, I can contract all the indices that I see here This box contains four indices outside, so that amounts to a four-leg tensor, a tensor with four indices. The important thing is that when I place this back inside the tensor network, so if I come here and I replace this square with this tensor, then I get my next manipulation. And my next manipulation, if you look carefully to it, is structurally identical to the previous one. Okay? So what this means is that in general, we are done in a couple of steps, but in general, we may have to repeat this log n times for very large n. Right? But at each step, we're just changing scale in some sense, and we just have to deal with a small number of tensors, as given by the content of this box. And we can just do that. It will have some cost. And now we have to repeat this. The important observation is that we don't build any big object in the process. Okay? We don't build an object with a number of legs that is, say, proportional to the system size. We are just repeating some small number of transformations building at each step a small tensor. And so we can do that, log n steps, and we are done. OK, so we've seen that with a mirror, we can indeed efficiently compute expectation values.
Memory storing this guy would be chi to the 4. The multiplications, the products that you have to implement in the meantime, it can grow up to chi to the 7. So there is some power, chi to the 7 or 8, right? Depending on how you do it, whether you introduce approximations. But it's a finite power that does not depend on the system size. That's the important aspect.
OK, so we can extract information. Excellent. Yes. So you can grow, yeah. Maybe in this type of schemes, we no longer, yeah. In this type of schemes, it's going to be 50 at most on this order. Yeah. If you have a finite system of size n, you'll have to do this log n times. So it's not a power, it's not exponential in n, it's actually less than linear. It's very good. OK. It does not depend. You're right to think that, well, it's a legitimate question, but you can show that wherever you put it, the cost is going to be the same.
OK. So that's one part of what I wanted to tell you about the mirror, which is this tensor network from which we can efficiently extract information. So now we could play around, try to optimize the tensors, and try to approximate a good the ground state of some local Hamiltonian in one dimension, for instance. And I'm not going to discuss this optimization process. What I want to do again is to argue that this tensor network is naturally equipped to represent certain types of states, as I did for the matrix product state. And so I want to look at decay of correlations and scaling of entanglement.
And for the MPS, correlations first, we just said that. We see that the correlations decay exponentially. And remember, that's what I want to remind you of. The reason is that two insertions at distance L, in order to evaluate this, you have to invoke or call a transfer matrix, multiply by a transfer matrix L times. Okay? So distance L, L multiplications. That gives us
this exponential decay. So let's look at the mirror.
Let's do something similar with the mirror.
So
what you have here is
the tensor network description of this two-point correlator that I want to evaluate. Right? So psi is described by a mirror, which is the upper half of this drawing. That's the cat. We have the bra on the lower half. Okay. This means this thing means that maybe the tensor network keeps going. I'm not going to worry about that part. And then I insert two operators, one side operator, say sigma z here and sigma x there, or whatever you want to do, on these two positions. And then
Again, if I want to compute this, again, this looks like trouble because it's a two-dimensional tensor network, but I can remember that there are all these cancellations. So all these cancellations will occur everywhere, U, U tag, and so on, except in the neighborhood of these insertions, where, for instance, this isometry here, this tensor cannot cancel with this one, and so on. And so after using all these cancellations, I get to this simplified drawing. So what happens is all the tensors disappear except for this that cannot cancel with this one, this that cannot cancel with this one, and so on, you know, on this side, and the same on the other side. That's exactly what you see here. Okay. So what we've done then is we've reduced a two-dimensional tensor network again into a one-dimensional one. And I'm just going to stretch this a little bit. So I take this tensor network, I take the blue dot, the blue circle, the red circle, and I stretch it, and I get to this construction. And I do that to make it more apparent that I have something very similar to what we had with the matrix product state. I have some vector to the left, some vector to the right, and something in the middle that appears if it happens, if these tensors happen to be the same, then I have the same matrix that appears a number of times. How many times? Well, this time, remember, these insertions were at distance L. But now this evaluation invokes only log L calls to the transfer metric. Okay, so there is a transfer matrix in scale now. Instead of in real space, we go through scale. And the distance, so in order to go from here to here, we just need to go up by log L steps, where L was the distance between the two insertions. And so there we have it. Every time we multiply by a matrix, there will be some dominant eigenvalue that will be picked up. Let's say it's lambda on this side, also lambda on the other side. And this will have this eigenvalue log L times, in particular log 3 L times. Okay. And once you have an expression of this form, you ask how this
what's the functionality in L in lambda, sorry. And what you realize is that
you use some simple equalities and you realize that this is actually
a power law in L.
Okay? Instead of, in order to go from A to B, instead of going through L multiplications, we just go through log L multiplications. That results
in a power law instead of an exponential decay, polynomial decay. Okay?
Okay, so you're asking whether, my argument was prepared, or I've prepared this particular, I've made the insertions in very special places here. So you're asking, what if I had put this insertion in here, not in here? Right, so then it would be much more complicated to argue the way I just argued. But what I'm going to say is the following. I'm just trying to give you an idea of how correlations decay in these ansatz. Assume that this ansatz is representing a translation invariant state through after the optimization. Then what you will see is that at certain locations, there is power law decay of correlations. And by translation invariant, then you should expect the same everywhere. OK? But indeed, strictly speaking, I'm only arguing. The point is, I'm arguing this even before the optimization. And so I need to use these special locations. Okay? It doesn't follow from the structure of the tensor network. I would first have to optimize the tensors. So before a property of the variational class, as a whole class of a state, is that if I evaluate expectation values of local insertion in special places, I get this power law decay. And that's all that I'm showing here. It may be, it's not obvious. So if it's just one unit, then you'll see that you don't have cancel. If you have the dot here, then you have cancellations everywhere except for this tensor, this tensor, and this tensor.
if we move now the blue dot here, this guy won't cancel, which implies these two guys won't cancel, which implies this. There
will be a thicker causal cone, or the number of tensors that will be left will be larger. You'll still see that after log L steps, you are done. But it's going to be much harder to argue that there is an eigenvalue that is being picked up. Okay, but I think that that's really not too important. I was just trying to give you an idea of how correlations, why correlations decay as a power law in the meta, and that you know, if we get this idea, that's good enough. And so in particular, let me see how we are doing. Okay, so in particular, just to summarize, we can try to intuitively say that what we have is that this tensor network is defining some discrete version of some geometry. In the case of the MPS, we're just following a one-dimensional geometry, whereas in the meta, we're adding an extra dimension, and then what we find is that the two-point correlators here follow between these two points follow or result from following geodesics in this geometry. And in the case of the meta, the geodesic counted, for instance, as how many tensors, the smallest number of tensors you have to jump over to go from here to here. It turns out that the shortest path include going into this additional direction. And of course, Rob Myers just gave us a lecture on holography, so this should resemble that a little bit. There was a question? That's right. So I'm assuming indeed, not only that I'm putting these tensors these insertions at special locations, but that all the tensors in my tensor network are the same, the same way that before in the MPS I was assuming that the tensors were also the same. So these structural properties are derived assuming, at least for correlations, assuming that all the tensors are the same in the tensor network. Okay, very good. So we don't have a lot of time left. Let me mention the entanglement entropy as well.
So remember, we saw that the entanglement entropy of an MPS was upper bounded by a constant, and that resulted directly from the way the tensors were connected, and in particular from the fact that if I wanted to study the reduced density matrix on region A, I could disconnect the region from the rest by cutting only two bonds, two indices. Okay, so that gave me this upper bound. So now we could ask the same question in the meta, and what we realize is that given a region A, we won't have the smallest number of indices that we need to cut in order to split this tensor network into two pieces, one containing A and one and the rest containing the rest of the spins, is not just two, but a larger number. Okay. And in the first case, we got this boundary law or area law for entanglement entropy. And in this case, what we get is actually a logarithmic an upper bound, which is logarithmic. What I'm saying is, if you count how many indices you have to cut, it turns out to be a number that grows logarithmically in the size of region A. And if you want to see more examples of this, I mean, explicitly, as you increase the size of region A, you see that indeed, the smallest number of cuts you have to introduce is growing because you have to go to higher and higher, higher up in this scale direction. And so if you do the numbers, you see that that's this. Every time you, essentially, every time you double the size of your interval, then you have to add a constant number of bonds that you cut. So that's the logarithmic growth. Very good. So so that's where I wanted, that's this, you know, the simple part. So what we've done so far in these lectures is we have answered the question, what's a tensor network state? And we use that diagrammatical notation. Hopefully, you are now comfortable evaluating the cost of multiplying two matrices and therefore two tensors and so on. And then we looked at what are the important aspects or questions that you have to ask to a tensor network to try to decide whether it's useful or not. And we talked about the efficient representation and computation. You always have to ask, do I have an efficient representation of a state? Can I efficiently extract information from it? And then also structural properties. And concretely, we look at two-point correlators and the entanglement entropy for a region, a connected region. And so what we saw is that, as a conclusion, that we had the two examples we looked at, matrix product state and meta, we had that they naturally had exponential decay of correlations and the saturation of the entangled entropy, and this was a match with the properties of ground states of Hamiltonians in 1D, Hamiltonians which were gapped, whereas the mirror was a match. This power law and logarithmic scaling was a match for ground states of gapless Hamiltonians in one dimension. So things that I did not discuss which are important, are also, for instance, how to optimize these variational parameters. I just didn't mention that. That's on purpose. This is a complete, it's a large subject on its own. I also, and there I can only say that, for instance, typical techniques we use is energy minimization. So we have the ability to efficiently evaluate the expectation value of the energy. So here's a technique, right? Change the variational parameters, compute the energy. Change again the variational parameters, compute the energy. Did the energy go down? Yes, then accept the changes in variational parameters, right? So you know that at least you can efficiently evaluate the energy and therefore for a choice of variational parameters, and therefore you could try to improve this variational energy by changing the variational parameters. Very good. Or you could also use imaginary time evolution, which I didn't discuss. Actually, matrix product states can be used not just to represent ground states, but also certain types of time evolution under, say, a local quench when you start from the ground state and now you modify your Hamiltonian or your system locally. You can actually follow the time evolution, right? So tensor networks can be used beyond ground state calculations. And then there is all these generalizations that have been proposed over the last 5 years. Where you take continuous version of this construction. So if you want to study field theories, at least certain types of field theories, there is a continuous version of these tensor networks. And finally, here I only mention for simplicity, tensor networks in one dimension, but of course there are two-dimensional and higher dimensional constructions, which I also did not discuss. Very good. So now I want to check the time. There are 10 minutes left. 15? Excellent. So I want to go a bit beyond what I've explained today. And then the next lecture, Wilke will go more deeply in certain algorithmic details. Is that correct? So let me try this. So we have introduced these answers, this meta, and I've argued that you can efficiently manipulate it, that it behaves, it has certain structural properties. But now I would like to gain some intuition of what it is that it might be useful for, just by trying to understand it from different perspectives. So the first one is, I'm going to say that Meta is a quantum circuit, okay? It's a quantum circuit where these tensors are actually gates. So we already have, remember that I said these tensors with four legs, they were unitary, so that's what a unitary gate is. And then we have these other tensors that I call isometries that had that constraint that with it adjoined, they also produce the identity. And so what we can do is we can promote those isometries to also being two qubit or two spin gates, unitary gates, by just adding an extra leg, which we fix to be in a fixed state zero. Okay? So this is always a possible. So any isometry can be amplified to be in a unitary in this way. And then I'm just going to replace them in the tensor network. And so this is still the same variational ansatz. I just change the way I look at the tensors. And then I'm just going to take these lines and bring them to the top. And what we have here is a quantum circuit that maps. Let me clean this up a little bit. So what we have here is a quantum circuit where you can think that on the top we have a product state of zeros, all the spins in state 0, 0, 0. And then we have the tensor network describes this quantum circuit or unitary evolution that maps. There is a time going downwards. This is not a physical time. It's some, you know, it's auxiliary time. It has nothing to do with the time in your quantum system that you're trying to simulate. I'm just trying to visualize what type of states we're creating, what these variational ansatz might be representing. And what I'm saying is that the meta, in its core, is the assumption that the ground state that you have in your system can be obtained through a quantum circuit of this form, okay? Where you start with all the spins in a completely unentangled state,
And then you untangle them slowly by means of these tensors. For instance, these two spins are in state 0 and 0. But after you have applied this unitary transformation, this gate, now they are in some entangled state, these two spins. Then you take one half of each of the spins and you make them interact or unitarily evolve together with another spin that is still in state 0. And you keep doing that. So you keep introducing new spins in a product state, and you mix them or you make them interact with, you entangle them with the previous spins which were already in entangled state. And so the idea is that you start with a state with no entanglement, and as a result of this particular construction, this quantum circuit, you end up with a state that is entangled. Okay? And maybe an important observation here is that if we now, this, I told you this was some auxiliary time, so we can also think of this time as flowing through scale. We are at large length scales here. For instance, this tensor here, whatever we do here will affect the wave function everywhere. Whereas whatever we do here in this tensor, if we change this tensor, we'll change the wave function only in the neighborhood of this tensor. So the idea is that we go from a completely an entangled state, a state with no entanglement, and we introduce entanglement slowly by considering first large length scales and then all the way down to short length scales. Okay? So we end up with a wave function that is naturally equipped or possess entanglement at all length scales. That's how we build it. Okay? We've been mixing this initial product state, we've been introducing entanglement at different length scales sequentially. So the wave function will end up having entanglement at all length scales, and that's a property that you would like to see in, say, the ground state of a critical theory. Yes? E to the minus? This is unitary? Yeah. And what you just said is not unitary. Sorry, can you say that again? Right. I see what you're saying. So well, this is unitary, and the construction you're proposing is not unitary, so I would not know how to relate them easily. Yes. Okay, so yesterday I argued that quantum circuits were useless. Excellent question. Okay. So yesterday I argued that if you have a quantum circuit of certain type, where if you remember the gates were distributed uniformly through time, we had rows of gates acting at different times, then there was this kind of causal cone that was growing when you would go back in time. But here, it's built in such a way that there is no growth of this causal cone. I'll actually get back to that in a minute. But it's a very good question. Okay, so another perspective which it's useful in order to interpret the mirror is to regard it as a cosinating transformation, as defining a renormalization group transformation. And I will insist tomorrow, the last lecture of this series will be on tensor networks and the renormalization group. So we'll revisit these ideas tomorrow. But let me start by saying this, that we used to think of cosinating transformations in real space as go to your spin system, go to your lattice, and decide to group together spins in blocks, okay, and try to replace those blocks by effective spins. And so this is, in terms of tensor networks, this is described here. We take these two spins. We have an original lattice. This is the original lattice. This will be the cosine lattice. And the relation between the spins on the initial lattice and the cosine lattice is that we take two spins. We replace the Hilbert space of two spins with a single spin by doing some choice, proper choice of Hilbert space locally. Okay. And so what I'm going to argue is that there is something that is missed in this class of schemes. And if you look at this will be one layer of tensors in the mirror.
And now what we want to do is to reinterpret the mirror not as a quantum circuit, but this time as a coserine transformation. And so that would be what it is. We are again putting these two spins together into a single spin. But before these two spins are put together into a single spin or are transformed or coserine into a single spin, we will allow for these two spins to talk to, for these two spins that we're putting together into a single spin, we'll allow them to talk to the nearest neighbors on each side, right? So we will take these spins, and before deciding that they become a single spin now, this spin is going to unitarily evolve with its neighbor, and the same on the other side. And you may wonder, well, why would you want to do this? And here is why. So let's consider this coserine transformation applied to a system which has short-range entanglement. So let's say that there is short-range entanglement between these two spins. These two spins are going to become a single spin. And so you don't need to worry about these microscopic details. They'll disappear from your description because entanglement is something connecting different spins. If two spins become the same spin, that entanglement is gone from the system. Okay? The same thing happens down here. We have two spins which are entangled at short distances, but these two spins will become the same spin, so the entanglement is gone. Okay? We are getting rid of microscopic details. That sounds good. We want to have a renormalization group transformation that gets rid of microscopic, irrelevant microscopic details of your system. So that's good. I'm just arguing completely locally. I'm just focusing on what happens to the entanglement between these two spins. So let me just focus on that, right? And I'm arguing that in both cases, we are getting rid of short-range entanglement, which is a good thing because these are microscopic details. And the goal of the renormalization group flow is to build an effective description that has forgotten about these microscopic details. But now let's do the same, but let's consider the entanglement between two spins that. So imagine that we have short-range entanglement between two spins that are not going to become the same spin, right? So this spin is going to be part of this effective spin, and this spin will become part of this other effective spin. So if we just coserine the Hilbert space like that, what happens is that we started with short-range entanglement, and after the coserining, this entanglement between this spin and this spin has been promoted to entanglement between this effective spin and that effective spin. Okay? So what that means is we have not been able to remove some part of the short distance microscopic details of the theory. Okay? Not only that, but we promoted short distance details to longer distance details. And that's the point of having these entanglers, these tensors here. They give you a chance before you put these two spins together and these two spins together in here. If these tensors allow these two spins to talk to each other and get rid of this entanglement. Okay? So the idea of adding these entanglers or this additional layer of tensors is that we can uniformly get rid of all short-range correlations, irrelevant degrees of freedom, during the coserine transformation. Yes? Actually, one of the problems today is to build the tensor network that results from here. And the implication is that the bond dimension that you will have to keep will grow with the scale. So you could represent power law, but at the cost of having an ansatz that is not scale invariant itself, but actually the cost of manipulating it will increase exponentially as you change the scale. Okay, so there are implications of this type. Yes. All I'm saying here is that by putting these guys here, you're giving yourself a chance to do something about the entanglement between these two spins. So you may choose these disentanglers to get rid of that. And right. So I'm not saying that this is the property I'm going to use to optimize these disentanglers. I'm saying that. Sorry? Yeah, yes. There is a chance. There is a chance. And that's all I want to emphasize, that before we didn't have a chance. If it was an EPR state that you are trying to disentangle, then it will produce a product state from the EPR state. And that's the unitary, I mean, that just defines part of a unitary transformation. You can complete it in many different ways. I don't know exactly what needs to be removed. I know all I'm stressing is that in that scheme, if there was some short range entanglement, see, this is a imagine this is a translation invariant state. In this link, you have the chance to remove this. I mean, actually, this short range entanglement will disappear. So it's only natural that my translation, if this was translation invariant, that you should also remove this entanglement here. And all I'm saying is that down here we have a chance, a fighting chance of achieving that. Okay? Good. So we can think of Mera as a real space Reynolds monetization group transformation of the type I just described with these exotic additional disentanglers. And then related to that is that, well, if we think then as this layer of tensors as being this coherent transformation, the Mera is just the composition of layers of coherent transformations. Okay, so we can interpret this tensor network as being the result, as describing a sequence of coherent transformations. Each layer, each double layer here, this layer here is a map between the original lattice and a coherent lattice that you obtain by cutting all these indices. And up here you have another lattice, and you realize if you had n spins here, you have n half spins, n over 4 spins, and so on. So you see that this tensor network has built in the notion of a renormalization group transformation. And in particular, when I tell you the Mera is a wave function, actually it's more than that. It's a sequence of wave functions, because this complete tensor network is describing the wave function at this scale. But if I remove this layer of tensors, I get a wave function in the next length scale, and so on. Okay, so when you see the Mera, you can think, it's okay to think of this not just as an ansatz for a wave function, but it's a collection of wave functions describing a flow in an energy flow. Okay, so let me check. Probably it's about time to stop. So let me just repeat this. This idea that we have an energy flow in the space of wave functions as characterized maybe by these tensors here. So these tensors, you can argue that they describe a wave function at some length scale, and you have this collection of tensors that you can use to define a flow in the space of tensors, okay, or wave functions. But I got this very often that, oh, you just have defined an energy flow in the space of wave functions, but what we really feel comfortable with is an energy flow in the space of Hamiltonians. And the good news is, okay. So we can also use the Mera to define an energy flow in the space of Hamiltonians. And the way this works is very simple. I just need to remind you that if I'm going to look at what happens to a local operator. So this would be a local operator acting on a lattice. It acts as the identity in all the sides except on 3 sides. Okay. So that's some operator on some local operator in our original lattice. And now if I want to constrain this lattice, I'm going to apply this constraining transformation as a ket and also as a bra. Okay? So if the wave functions transform acting with some operator, the operators act by conjugating by that operator. So I apply bra and ket, the constraining transformation. And now you look at this and you say, oh, there is a problem here. This is not a local operator anymore. It's a mess. It's non-trivial on, these indices correspond to the sides of the constraining lattice. And what we see is that this is no longer local. It's acting on all the sides, but remember the simplifications that we had. So this guy simplifies with this one and so on. And so after applying the simplifications, you realize, oh no, actually this is still a three-body operator. Okay? So the conclusion is that we've mapped the coherent transformation defined by the Mera is one that respects locality. When you apply it to local operators, you obtain local operators as a result. And so in particular, you can apply it to the Hamiltonian of your system, and it will constrain your Hamiltonian, which is sum of local terms, into a new constrained Hamiltonian, which is also sum of local terms. Okay? So the conclusion is that the Mera defines both energy flow in the space of wave functions, but also in the space of Hamiltonians. And I'm going to leave it here, and tomorrow I'll continue with that.